Hi there, this is Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. I just finished having a really fascinating conversation with Andrew F. Jones about his new book, Developmental Fairy Tales, Evolutionary Thinking and Modern Chinese Culture, that just came out with Harvard University Press in 2011. Simply put, this is a book that you should read. This is an incredibly fascinating study of the ways that a discourse of development sort of taken up by works of evolutionary biology and works of science fiction and other kinds of tropes that were translated in the context of modern China and vernacularized into a set of media that includes film and toys and fiction and that relates themes of childhood and fairy tales just all kinds of really fascinating things together. It's a wonderful book, and we had a wonderful time talking about it. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
We're here today at the New Books Network to talk with Andrew Jones about his recent book, Developmental Fairy Tales, Evolutionary Thinking and Modern Chinese Culture, and that just came out hot off the presses with Harvard University Press in 2011. Now, I've already told Andrew I absolutely loved reading this book. It's a really brilliant study of the ways that a discourse of development was taken up from evolutionary works that were, you know, many of us are familiar with in our histories of science, Lamarck, Darwin, Spencer, Huxley, and the way that discourse of development was translated or vernacularized into narrative forms of modern Chinese literature. It's a really wonderful book, and I'm really thrilled, Andrew, that you've made time to talk with us today. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
So, Andrew, could you start off by telling us a little bit about your background?
Sure. I teach modern Chinese literature and cultural studies, media studies here at Berkeley, University of California. My training was in literature, mostly modern literature. But somehow I've also been consistently interested in music and media technology and their links to one another. So this book was a little bit of a departure in that in some ways it seems to constellate around intellectual history as well. But perhaps it brings together all these various different aspects.
Great. And actually, that was really striking to me because the first encounter that I had with your work was actually your earlier work on music, which is also really fascinating. How did you make the move from music to this kind of topic?
That's a pretty interesting question. I think there's probably a couple ways of answering it. One is that when I was writing Yellow Music, which was my previous book about the development of media culture and music in Shanghai in the 20s and 30s. One of the main characters was a man named Li Jinghui, who was sort of reviled for many years as the creator of this kind of degraded, salacious, colonial mix of jazz music and Chinese folk music. But Li Jinghui, it turns out, was also a really interesting figure because he pioneered Mandarin language education during the May 4th movement and actually edited a journal called Xiao Peng Yo, Little Friend, a children's magazine. So I was kind of interested in children's literature and kind of children's publishing through having come into contact with his story. And at the same time, studying a lot of the writings about music by May 4th intellectuals, I was increasingly kind of struck and actually sometimes a little bit dismayed by the ubiquity and sort of blunt force of their developmentalist critique of Chinese music. Mm-hmm. They're perfectly happy saying, people like Xiao Youmei, who founded the Shanghai Conservatory of Music, were perfectly happy to say things like, well, Chinese music is 1,000 years behind the West, and we need to just simply jettison it in favor of the advanced or evolutionarily advanced forms like German Romanticism. And that kind of thinking actually also resonated a lot with literary history and, in fact, a whole range of discourses that I had read about or kind of absorbed through reading a lot of materials from that period. So that was part of the motivation to write this book.
Great. And had you been interested in the history of evolutionary biology or translations of evolutionary thought before this, or was this, have you worked on this before, or how did you get interested in this focus on evolution in particular?
I had a sort of passing interest in evolutionary theory, but no, I had to kind of learn the field from scratch to do the book. What happened really was, if there's a developmental fairy tale with a moment of sort of evolutionary mutation that started the book, it was one afternoon when I was in the library at the University of Washington in Seattle, where I was teaching at the time. And, well, I guess I could say this is a story in praise of analog sources and stacks and libraries. So I was just looking through the section, I think, about children's literature, children's studies, and found an old book from 1937 by a child psychologist, Huang Yi, about the psychology of children's drawings. And I opened up the book, and I was just really, really struck by the drawings inside. They're quite beautiful. They're very expressive of the characters that are drawing, like a coolie, a woman who might be a streetwalker or a fashion plate on the streets.
Right. These are the drawings in chapter 3, right?
Exactly. And I also knew from being kind of immersed in that period that there was a very strong historicity to the pictures. For instance, the clothes the woman was wearing were very, they could be dated to a certain summer because of the way that they looked, the style that she was wearing. So I was really struck by that, and then struck by the contrast with how Huang Yi portrayed these pictures as being merely a kind of way to understand the developmental process or developmental order, as he put it, that these children needed to be slotted into in their progress from primitivism to realism. And that really set me off. I started thinking about where these kind of terms or where that seemingly inevitable kind of developmental story came from, and tracing the thread back to its origin kind of led to having to absorb a lot of material about evolutionary thinking and evolutionary theory as it gets translated into China since the late Qing era.
I mean, that aspect of the book is actually really fascinating for those of us who work on the history of science and medicine, right? Because this is just a wonderful example of a study that really crosses boundaries between, you know, modern Chinese studies, modern Chinese lit, and history of science, and I think a really, really productive way. So let's get into it.
Okay.
So we'll definitely get to that set of really evocative children's drawings that you just mentioned that I really loved. And they're one, that's one of many vignettes that's really engaging that you use to open and close these chapters. So the book actually begins with another vignette. This is in the introduction, and it's a description by a writer that's going to recur throughout this story, Lu Xun, mm-hmm. Of an impromptu magic show from a piece called Modern History. So can you start us off by saying a little bit about this magic show and what it has to do with the larger context of the book and the story that you're telling?
Mm-hmm. That piece in particular is quite wonderful. It's one of the many, many zaowen that Lu Xun wrote.
Yeah.
Particularly in the early 30s for Shen Bao, the kind of newspaper record in Shanghai at the time. And actually, Lu Xun seemed a little bit obsessed with this scene of magic shows or Bian Qi Fa that you could witness on the streets in Shanghai and other places in China at that time, apparently with some regularity. So he came back to this motif actually in several different essays. This is one of the more interesting and powerful ones. And basically, he's writing about how these magic shows are a kind of deceitful spectacle, that they involve certain kinds of magical transformations, all of them, I suppose, staged, of course, and then people watch them, they give them money, and then they come back again. But in all of these shows, the common denominator is adults who are manipulating animals or children and kind of exploiting them for the purpose of the spectacle. And I think Lu Sheng comes back to this image again and again because it seems to him a proper parable for sort of inevitability of oppression and a kind of cyclical view of history where there's this sort of endless and endlessly repeatable theater of cruelty. And it becomes a powerful image because, you know, Lu Sheng was schooled in and powerfully motivated by evolutionary theory and the hope for kind of an intellectual agency that could change the world. And yet, certainly by the early 30s, if not throughout his career, he's also tortured by this sort of doubt or even a Nietzschean image of eternal return where nothing really matters, nothing really changes. So I use the anecdote to sort of get into that issue of the paradox or some of the internal contradictions of his generation's faith and also doubt in this mode of developmental thinking or evolutionary thinking.
Right. Sorry. And actually, the phrase that you just brought up, developmental thinking or evolutionary thinking, this really introduces what goes on to be the main theme, or certainly one of the main themes of the book, which is the emergence of a discourse of development, right, and developmental thinking in the Chinese literary and media culture of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So for listeners who haven't yet had the opportunity to read the book, can you say a little bit about what development means in this context?
Sure. It's actually not an easy question.
Right. Right. I mean, in some ways, that's what the book is all about, like unpacking.
Right. Joined into that question, but I'll take a stab at it. If we wanted to start in the sort of contemporary scene, I don't think it's a secret that something that we might call developmentalism, Fajianzhuyi, is fairly deeply embedded in the DNA of modern Chinese political culture and even, of course, government policy. I quote in the book Deng Xiaoping's famous injunction that development is the only hard imperative, Fajianzhuyi. And, you know, we typically understand development as economic development or national development, or even through the UN Index of Human Development. But what I'm arguing is that this is actually only the tip of the iceberg in a way, that if we trace this idea back to the late 19th century, what we see is that development is really a mode of narrating history and narrating history often with the nation as its subject. And it's also, when I say it's a mode, I think what's important there is that it somehow seems to be a way of thinking or a narrative form that can be broadly applicable in a lot of different fields. And it often presupposes a kind of movement from the primitive to the civilized, from the simple to the complex and multiply articulated. That way of thinking, or that particular mode of thinking history or thinking nation, I'm arguing, kind of makes its entrance into the Chinese discursive universe through, for instance, Yan Fu's translation of Huxley's work. But it becomes something much more than that. It's something that kind of moves into the culture in a capillary way and becomes a way of explaining or narrating the sort of predicaments that China was facing in the early 20th century. So that's one stab at it. Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much.
Further complications have to do with, I think, one of the central contradictions or paradoxes I'm trying to get at in the book, especially through looking at Lu Xun's writing, is a couple different senses of development that I think are very difficult to reconcile. And one is the intransitive sense, that is, things, as in Darwinian evolutionary theory, things will develop of themselves, right? They don't need to be pushed forward In fact, human efforts to push evolution forward are simply moot, really. They don't count. The time scale is so long, and the process is so contingent that we don't really matter. Intellectuals don't really matter. So this is, might be a kind of intransitive view of development. But for Chinese intellectuals, it was much more vital, at least for most of them, to try to understand development as being a transitive process. That is something that they themselves had some kind of agency in pushing forward, especially when they were trying to understand China as a nation among other nations that had kind of fallen behind in an evolutionary race or, you know, survival of the fittest sort of situation. And that contradiction, I'm arguing, kind of plays out in a lot of the stories and texts I look at in ways that sort of make the stories themselves a little bit tortured or unsustainable in the end.
Right. And this tension between ideas of sort of evolutionary development that incorporates the possibility of individual agency versus not also speaks to these different contexts that you talk about in the book between sort of translating Darwinian versus Lamarckian ideas of evolutionary progress, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about that for our listeners who may not be familiar with the Lamarck versus Darwin way of thinking about evolution?
Sure. This is a, you know, a kind of long running controversy in evolutionary theory. And I actually have heard that recently some Lamarckian ideas are starting to make a comeback.
Right.
Which is quite interesting. But basically the Lamarckian notion, which I think for a lot of Chinese intellectuals and intellectuals in the West until up until including the 1930s, found really attractive, was the notion of the genetic inheritance of acquired characteristics, right? That is, you know, since giraffes keep stretching their necks out, the second generation of giraffes will have longer necks. And in that crude form, it's basically been disproved by genetics and Mendelian theories of inheritance. But it was actually a pretty live controversy until the 20s, at least. And as evolutionary theory kind of enters into journalism and into the discourse of politics and into, popular sociology, that is, as it becomes vernacularized, I think a rough and ready, more or less Lamarckian view comes to, you know, win the day, or to become a certain kind of common sense in the West as in China alike. And I'm kind of arguing that's particularly important for intellectuals, journalists, opinion leaders in China, because they so desperately want to feel that their agency as intellectuals will have some kind of bearing on China's developmental process or its effort to manage the problems of modernity.
Right.
Yeah.
And throughout the chapters of the book, actually, the book takes on and develops this, no pun intended, actually, but develops this idea of the importance of the vernacular and the vernacularization to understanding the history of science and the history of developmental thinking sort of within that as well. And I think a really helpful way. And this is the example of evolutionary thinking and the translation of evolutionary thinking as you take us through in this book is also really interesting, because for a lot of scholars of the history of life sciences and evolutionary thinking, it's also very much the case that we tend to understand evolutionary thinking itself as also always being shaped by prevailing economic and political and cultural discourses, right? So this is a really, I think, very powerful example that you're showing of the vernacularization of those ideas much more widely, though, than we typically take for granted, that we typically look at in, children's books and films and all kinds of wonderful sources. So to get us there, you began the introduction to this book and the introduction to many of these really fascinating themes with a magic show. And the chapter also ends with a magic show. It ends with a magic show in particular that involves a child and a bear cub. That's also a very powerful vignette. Can you explain that briefly for our listeners?
The anecdote from the Lucian essay?
Yeah, the child and the bear cub that ends.
Right.
The first chapter.
Let's see if I can remember it.
if you want. We can also...
No. What was that particular song?
Let me get to it. It's the child and the beast. He says, I like watching magic shows. He goes on, and it's this account of the beating... of the training involving sort of pain and beating and trauma of the child and the bear that are taking part in these magic shows. Let's see.
Right. So this goes back to what I referenced before, that Lucian seems to see in these shows a parable of oppression and of a kind of historical pattern that can only repeat itself over and over again. So the bear is part of the show. He's half starved. And I think very typically for Lucian, he kind of cites some report by Westerners that talks about how Chinese magic shows are very cruel to these bears. So he's being exploited, or he's willing to be obedient precisely because he's half starved. But there's also a child involved in the show who's basically tortured. So as a kind of spectacle, the grown-ups stand on his belly, they twist his arms, and then the child performs his pain. So he ends by saying, at the end of each show, I think to myself as I walk away, there are two kinds of moneymakers. One kind is abused to death until another is found as a replacement. And he's talking about the bear. The other kind will grow up to acquire a little child and a bear cub and go on performing the same old tricks. It's really very simple and even seems a bit tedious when you think about it. Yet I go on watching these shows. What else would you have me look at, dear readers? So you can see that he's trying to get a bead on the perpetuation of this kind of spectacle, and obviously talking about a larger phenomena than merely magic shows.
Right. Mm. Thank you so much. So moving on, the next chapter of the book is just really, really wonderful. And it explores the emergence of developmental narratives in which human history is related really interestingly in terms of natural history. Mm-hmm. Now, it centers on a case study of a work that I'd actually never heard of. I was fascinated by this. It's a work by Wu Jianren called The New Story of the Stone. Right. Can you describe the nature of this work for our listeners?
Okay, sure. This is a late Qing novel. It's actually from the first decade of the 20th century, which is a kind of remake of Honglomong. But told from a sort of science fiction perspective. Zha Baoyu, the hero of that great Qing novel, is essentially resurrected or comes back to life in contemporary Shanghai of 1905. And he kind of sheds all of his romanticism and becomes an ardent nationalist. He tries to learn about the modern world. He's shocked by, you know, matches and steamboats, and he goes to the Jiangnan arsenal and you know, gets lots of books and starts to read up. But what starts to happen is that he becomes increasingly sort of depressed and disillusioned because he's faced all around him with these absurdities of contemporary Chinese life and the horrors of colonialism. The Boxer Rebellion erupts. Eventually, he's captured by local authorities, I think in Wuhan or somewhere in the interior, and almost killed just for speaking out about educational policy. And at a certain point in the novel, things become so bad that it sort of lurches into science fiction. And he crosses over into a new realm called the Wenming Jingjie, or you could translate that as the realm of civilization. it could also maybe be translated as the modern world or the modern realm.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a kind of compensatory science fiction utopia that makes up for all of the depredations and all the disillusionment of real Shanghai in 1905. It's a world in which China has developed to a degree that it's already surpassed the West. So it's a kind of fantasy of, you could call it immaculate development. And it's affected through a dream image. Basically, this world is a dream into which Zhao Baoyu has entered. The tragedy of the book is at the end, he wakes up and sort of tumbles back into the black hole of history with an even greater sense of disillusionment. Listen, this is an example I'm trying to argue about the problem of telling stories based around evolutionary premises is that since evolutionary time is usually glacial, very, 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 very slow, novelists like Wu Jianren need to create a wrinkle in time in order to sort of imagine a future in which developmental processes have already taken place. It introduces a kind of hole in the middle of the story. And that's exactly the hole that Zhao Baoyu falls into in the end when he wakes up and finds that, you know, things are just as bad as they've always been.
Right. I mean, this is a really fascinating case study, and it made me want to immediately go out and read the novel, frankly, because
it's a lot of fun.
it does seem like a lot of fun. I mean, in the course of this novel, in the description that you provide us really helpfully in the book, there are a number of transformations that are happening that are really kind of wonderful for those of us who know something about traditional Chinese literature or natural history. So one of the things that really struck me is that you describe the incorporation of what we might sort of in scare quotes call, you know, traditional Chinese modes of knowing, of knowing the world into a range of technological devices, mm-hmm. like devices for detecting qi and
right.
things like this. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because those are just completely fascinating.
it's interesting. I guess at the border of the Liming Jingjie, the realm of civilization, there's sort of x-rays, but they're x-rays that allow authorities to see if your, you know, qi is adequate enough to enter into the modern realm, which I guess one ups the Department of Homeland Security. It's even better than any technology we have today. And throughout that section, Wu Jianren plays this game. He kind of posits technologies that outwest the West and in fact are based on early texts or based on the assumptions of early sort of preaching philosophy. So it's a kind of brilliant, I don't know, turnaround or philosophical move. And it's actually one that had by that time, a kind of tradition in the Yang Wu intellectual movement from the mid to late Qing, of kind of locating even, say, evolutionary theory in some writers' eyes could find some kind of precedent in Zhuangzi or some kind of precedent in even in the Analects. Unfortunately, however, a precedent that wasn't fully developed. So there's a lot of that kind of commentary in Yan Fu and earlier. So he's kind of concretizing those sort of notions there. But also, what's quite interesting is Zhao Baoyu also becomes a sort of Jules Verne-like figure in the realm of civilization, and he goes out across the world, and it doesn't seem to be a world with any borders, or maybe it's a world that's completely dominated by a Chinese empire. So he flies through Africa and he goes out in search of natural historical specimens, much like a Western imperialist adventurer at the time. And he even nets a quen, the giant fish, and a peng bird, and brings them back to a huge museum of natural history in the Wenming Jingjie. So there's a kind of, I don't know, parody. I'm not sure if it's a parody or a fantasy of complete knowledge and the complete assimilation of all of the entire Chinese tradition and literary tradition to this kind of gigantic museum, which is both modern and the basis for a new civilization.
it's so brilliant and so fascinating. And you actually,
it's so sad to think that the pungbird becomes a sort of embalmed specimen.
It's a sort of murdering to dissect, right? Do you know offhand if there's a translation of that work available, just in terms of thinking of assigning it to students?
Unfortunately, there isn't yet, but it would be a great idea.
Yeah. Mental note. And actually, in the course of this, you just mentioned Jules Verne. And one of the things that you bring up in this chapter that's also really interesting is sort of the way the translation of works of science fiction, including Verne by Lu Xun, actually helped shape this discourse of development in this period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things I look at in that chapter is the way that, in a somewhat unlikely or counterintuitive way, that I'm arguing that some of the works of Lu Xun, for instance, are actually quite deeply shaped by what I'm trying to call a sort of novel of evolutionary adventure. That is, novels like Bellamy's Looking Backward, a kind of American utopian novel, or Jules Verne, that try to play with evolutionary time and sketch out the consequences of thinking about history and evolutionarily in evolutionary ways. So Looking Backward was a text that was really, really formative for a lot of intellectuals in the late Qing, including Lu Xun, and kind of look at the interesting relationships between Looking Backward, its translation into Chinese, Lu Xun's translations of Jules Verne, and then finally his own work and its appropriation of evolutionary ideas.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of fascinating kinds of sources that you really gift us with in this book, the next chapter continues this exploration to look at what you I think called the vernacularization of evolutionary thought. And in particular, one of the fascinating kinds of sources that this chapter discusses is a set of children's primers that incorporate sort of modes of classifying animals into vocabulary. And so you talk a lot about the images of animals and sort of pedagogy in children's books in this chapter. Can you talk a little bit about these children's books, these primers in particular?
Oh, sure. First thing, just to continue an earlier theme, I should give credit to the Coatsen Children's Library at Princeton, which has an amazing collection of global children's literature, including a huge, huge cache of Chinese children's literature primers, textbooks from the Republican period, late Qing, and past the 1949 divide as well. So it was invaluable to look at those materials there. I think the idea of reading those materials is one of the kind of persistent concerns of the book is the way in which children became one of the main instruments through which Chinese intellectuals, educators, writers were trying to think through the question of development. Children seem to embody, quite literally, developmental processes, and they became a sort of figure upon which or through which intellectuals could posit or perhaps even affect that process through education. So children's books are kind of become an instrument in affecting development, and I look at them from that standpoint. But also, they're kind of interesting vernacular museum of, you know, how scientific ideas were taught to children, how they're figured both in stories and illustrations, and how kind of new way of understanding the world or the nation as being biological comes through in these texts, which I think I call something like, you know, information texts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, these texts are just full of really striking images of children learning with animals, learning from animals, mm-hmm. playing with animals. I mean, are there any particular texts that you actually experienced in the Coatsen Children's Library that really struck you in this way?
Well, there's quite a few. It's spent a lot of time looking at these, and I got particularly interested in the cover images of some of the more prominent journals. Basically, there were two competing magazines that were trying to capture the children's market, which often means, I guess, catching the attention of educators or parents as well. And that was Arthongshijie and Xiaopengyou. They were produced respectively by Zhonghua Shujui and Shangwen Chuguan, the commercial press, and China Book Bureau, which of course were the two major dominating players in the textbook market as well as in the literary market. And in fact, a lot of their work was subsidized by the textbook market. So each of them had their kind of flagship children's magazine. And when you look through those magazines, there's some very striking kind of recurring images or tropes or themes. There's a lot of stories about, I guess you could put it, a sort of dog-eat-dog world in which there's a struggle for survival. So it's a pretty crude instantiation of a certain idea of evolutionary development that's kind of made into children's stories. But in the pictures themselves, they're often quite whimsical and funny. For instance, you know, an elephant practicing piano as a little girl watches the elephant learn piano, that kind of thing. Children dancing with dogs or monkeys. I was very interested in this, you know, from a social historical viewpoint, probably not too many kids, for instance, had domestic pets, even dogs, except maybe, you know, well-off families in Shanghai or Tianjin or in the kind of coastal treaty port cities. But these images actually were being sent around the country to public schools and even deep into the interior. So it's kind of curious about what they were trying to say or why these tropes kept repeating so often. I think one reason is, of course, that it seems the purpose of education was to effect a developmental process that would kind of separate children from the mere savage or the merely bestial. So that kind of process is encoded in these pictures, often in sort of, you know, reversible ways, ways that play on the closeness actually between children and animals. And I try to put these pictures and images also in a larger sort of global context of colonialism and of an anxiety about whether or not China or Chinese children can become civilized, can become modern, as it were, and how that process of becoming can be managed by educators and intellectuals.
Right. And yeah. this actually raises a theme that continues through the rest of the book. And so if we move to chapter three from this discussion, mm-hmm. you call this somewhere, I don't know if it's in the introduction or in this chapter, but an introduction to the cultural history of the child in modern China. And this theme and the importance of the child as a figure, the pedagogy of the child in the narrative discourse of development really recurs throughout the rest of the book in fascinating ways. Now, one of the major sources that is extraordinarily striking that begins this chapter is the source that you actually mentioned earlier in this interview when you talked about the source that really got you interested in thinking about development in the first place. And this is this 1937 book on the psychology of children's drawings. Mm-hmm. So you've talked a little bit about these images, but can you say a little bit more about the context of this book as a whole and the kind of work that it's doing in terms of the argument that you're making in this chapter?
Well, starting from those images again.
Yeah. Well, they're really striking, right? And it's sort of, the chapter opens with them, and this is after we've been, after you've shown us these wonderful cover images of children playing with animals, and, you know, the elephant playing the piano, and then mm-hmm. it moves to this very, very different kind of image that still is very much about the sort of understanding the child as a figure in this larger cultural history, but through a very different kind of image that I had never seen images like that in, you know, in a Chinese text before.
So right. Mm-hmm. Later on, when I was thinking, just recently, I thought about those images again, and it struck me that they're a little bit like the photographs of August Sander, the famous German portrait photographer who kind of systematically created a gallery of social types in his photographs of Germany in the early 20th century. Walter Benjamin has written quite beautifully about his photography. So looking at those pictures, they are quite different than those portrayals of children in children's magazines, and that they seem to represent or give us a taste of the way that children could actually look at the world critically and in a way that was based on their own historical experience. But the tension that sort of got this project started was my sense that actually somehow Huang Yi, the child psychologist who compiled the pictures, wasn't able or wasn't interested in giving children their due or allowing them to speak historically. Instead, he wanted to sort of plug them into what he saw as a universal developmental process through which actually they would be tamed in a sense, or in which this kind of very striking social vision that they manifest in the drawings would be tamed. And that's an interesting word to use, I suppose, because I also relate this back later on in the book to a trope that Lu Xing likes to evoke a lot about the taming of animals as a kind of parable of the taming of Chinese people as sort of colonial subjects or modern subjects. I think the images there can speak to a lot of the themes that resonate through the book. Mm-hmm. And actually, if I had to characterize my method, which wasn't entirely conscious as I was writing the book, but it seems to operate through tropes or images that sort of resonate with one another throughout and keep sort of recurring throughout the book. So I'd say that that's one way that I can situate it, the larger project, around those images.
Yeah, thank you. And this chapter also goes on to really explicitly take on one of the themes that's in the title, developmental fairy tales. Mm. And so you argue here that the discourse of fairy tales and sort of folklore studies is central. The discourse of fairy tale and folklore studies is central to this chapter. And you argue that there are important discussions of the nature of progress and the role of children's development that are embedded in discussions of child's play and in fairy tales in this period. So can you tell us a little bit more about the importance of fairy tales for readers who, or for listeners who, again, haven't had the chance to read this book yet?
Yeah, absolutely. This actually speaks to the one thrust of the book, which is explicitly about modern Chinese literature and modern Chinese literary history. As is, I think, really widely known, Zhou Zuoren and Lu Xing and their sort of group or coterie of intellectuals around Beijing University in the late teens, early 20s, were fascinated by folklore studies and by children's literature, children's songs, because they saw it as perhaps representing a sort of primitive or vital energy, a popular energy that could be harnessed in creating a new vernacular. And so children's songs and even the idea of kind of tonghua, children's stories or fairy tales, became kind of central to them in trying to articulate or theorize, you know, how modern Chinese literature was going to develop. At the same time, fairy tales were really important because they saw them as the kind of the origin or the primitive origin of fiction. Mm-hmm. But they were also important because they also saw them as being instrumental in helping children develop into new, modern, properly schooled subjects. So there's also another kind of contradiction, I think, embodied in their take on fairy tales. It was a genre that was burdened with both being primitive, savage, a source of vitality out of which a new literature could develop, and also a means to develop children in a kind of pedagogical, pedantic way. And that tension sort of informs a lot of debates they had, and actually, I argue, some of their writings as well.
Right. And and along with fairy tales and sort of showing the importance of this, of fairy tales to this discourse, you also talk about how this plays out in the context of toys, of children's toys, and sort of advertisements for educational toys and discussions of educational toys. Can you say a little bit about that?
Sure. And I should note there's Sue Fernsentner has also done some really interesting work on toys. And the discourse of toys at this period. Well, one aspect of this is that I'm really interested in the book, not only how a discourse of development or developing children becomes really important at this time, but also the way in which it's materially linked in or commercially linked into the growth of the publishing industry. And the growth of a kind of industry centered around children and education. So there's also a sort of, you know, social history or business history aspect to looking at these kind of materials. For instance, commercial press, which had a basically a very lucrative monopoly on selling textbooks to public schools, also went into the kind of toy industry. And at the same time that they were publishing huge amounts of materials about how to, you know, make your child into a modern citizen and publishing children's magazines for kids and publishing fairy tales. They also, and publishing manuals about how to, you know, provide the right toys for your children. They also went into the toy business. So it was a kind of discourse about children that was also fueled by selling goods to children, to their parents, who wanted to make better children, to make a better nation. So there's a certain circularity to the whole venture. And toys became pretty important in this discourse for a couple of reasons. One is that they're highly saleable commodities, but also the idea was that toys should be Chinese made. And this obviously gets into the material that I present, I guess, in the next chapter, which is about a film called Playthings.
Right.
Xiaowangye, which is completely centered around toy makers and toys as a kind of metaphor for the very serious adult concerns of China's domination by foreign powers, both militarily and economically.
Mm-hmm. Can you actually, it's a totally fascinating film. And you actually begin the next chapter, chapter four, with this set of photo montages that pair images of toys with ones of emaciated children in a really, really striking way. And then move to this discussion of the film. Can you actually talk a little bit more, for our listeners about, either or both of these really, fascinating sets of images? Like the.
Sure. Yeah, the images are, they're from a magazine that was published in the 1930s in Shanghai called Shidai Manhua. And I was really actually very delighted to see that, there's now a module in the MIT Visualizing Cultures.
Really?
Website that actually includes all of these images and a really well-written essay, a wonderfully informative essay by a colleague of ours. Giving a background to that so everyone can go look at those images and kind of revel in their amazing creativity and their acerbic and kind of desperately satirical commentary on contemporary Chinese life in the 30s. So I had looked through those magazines, you know, on paper years ago in Shanghai, and those particular images were quite interesting because they present children's toys kind of arrayed or in matching images with photographs of children who are starving in the countryside. I think most of them are from, you know, 1934, 1935. And the implicit commentary has to do with the idea that children should not become commodities, or commodities should not become children. There shouldn't be some kind of exchangeability between the two. So it's a very interesting commentary on the commodity form, but also an interesting commentary on I guess, a certain fetishization of children in the cities, where as children in the countryside were suffering terrible, terrible fates. So it's a very trenchant commentary, and one that leads me into discussing contemporary discourse around the year 33-34 about toys and about the movement to promote domestic goods in China, and about the way in which children were often starting to become conceptualized or viewed as guohuo, as domestic products, mm-hmm. as products to be formed through educational products, again, to represent China on a kind of international market or international stage. And these are that kind of tendencies is being critiqued in Shidai Manhua, Modern Sketch, as it was known in English. And it also kind of informs this film, Playthings. And the film is by one of the great directors of the Chinese leftist film movement in the early 30s, Song Yu. And it's about a toy maker, a kind of artisanal toy maker who lives in the countryside, played by Railing Yu, the great silent film actress of that era. And she has a kind of workshop or cottage industry production, but because of the civil war and because of economic displacement, she's driven into a shanty town in Shanghai. And we see a process whereby, you know, the production of toys is kind of taken over by the national bourgeoisie, in this case by a kind of returnee student from Germany who starts a factory and starts producing these industrially. And the film, at first glance, seems to be praising or talking about the inevitability of the modernization of the Chinese toy industry as a way of talking about Chinese national resistance and its economic development. And of course, this is another story about development, child development and economic development mixed together. But in the end, our heroine, Ranling Yu, the toy maker, is so brutally dispossessed of everything she ever had, her business, her daughter, who's killed in the Japanese attack of 1931. And then finally, actually, her son, who it turns out has been kidnapped and adopted by the guy who's opened the factory, by someone related to him. So it's a very kind of brutal story of dispossession in the end, under the guise of a story about economic and national development. And again, I'm trying to tease out some of those contradictions that exist in this developmental story. And the film was very popular. It was one of the great kind of successes of the Shanghai leftist cinema in the year 1933.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. So because I don't want to take up too much of your time, let's actually move to the final chapter.
Okay.
We come to the final chapter, and this is the chapter right after Playthings of History, where we also come to one of sincerely my favorite historical characters in any of the books that I've read in recent memory. There's a lot of books. And this is a blind Russian anarchist and Esperanto advocate, Vasily Eroshenko.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's no way I'm going to even remotely do justice to how awesome this guy is. So
amazing.
If you don't mind, could you explain a little bit about who he is and a little bit about his awesomeness for our listeners? Because he is incredibly awesome.
Well, you've said it all. He was a blind anarchist Esperantist. He's a really amazing figure. And the more you scratch the surface, the more it becomes this kind of marvelous and untold tale of transnational connections and of this sort of amazing, vibrant world of thought and energy from that period. But he was blind. He was from near the border with Ukraine. He went to the Moscow School of the Blind. One of the amazing anecdotes that I came across is that he claimed later on that his sort of commitment to anti-racism and anti-imperialism. Oh, there's my phone.
That's okay.
Had to do with the visit to his school one day of a Chinese gentleman He had been told all sorts of sort of negative catechism about the inferiority of the yellow race. But a Chinese gentleman visited their school. He couldn't see him. Of course, he was both blind and colorblind. But he felt his gentleness and his sort of cultivation. This kind of led him to question everything he'd learned from his teachers. It turned out that that gentleman was Li Hongzhang, who was visiting Moscow at the time, and had visited the school on a whim when he was walking down the block from visiting a Russian tea merchant. This is just one of those awesome stories about Lukashenko. So he ended up going to England first, and then becoming a sort of educator for the blind in India, in Burma, and then finally in Japan. And everywhere he went, he was basically kicked out by local governments, either colonial governments or, in the case of Japan, the sort of local government who suspected that he was a seditious character. I guess he had made friends with a lot of local socialists and anarchists. So he ended up being taken in by none other than Lu Xun and Zhou Zhouren at their home in Beijing and living with them for about a year. And lecturing at Beijing University on women's rights and on Russian literature. And at the same time, I think I'm trying to argue having a really quite profound influence on Lu Xun's writing as he translated and worked with Yeroshenko to kind of think about and theorize and write modern Chinese children's literatures and fairy tales. So that's kind of the story in a nutshell. And at the same time, in Beijing, he also had a sort of group of people around him from all over the world, actually, from Burbank, California, and from Japan, and from Korea, and elsewhere, who were this kind of international group of anarchists and writers. It was a very lively scene. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, one of the works that Lu Xun translated by him was this piece called A Narrow Cage that you, I was delighted to find that you give us a translation of it in the appendix.
Right.
And this story is really striking and really kind of forms the centerpiece of this chapter and the work, a lot of the work that this last part of the book is doing. Can you explain the story briefly for our listeners?
Mm-hmm. It's a very strange, enigmatic and a kind of magical story, I think. I was really struck by it when I first came across it. It's interesting, actually, because Yeroshenko is fairly unknown in Russia. But of course, he has a certain fame or notoriety in China, simply because of his association with Lu Xun. But this story in particular was, I think, the first one that Lu Xun translated of his, and it appeared in Xin Qingnian, New Youth. So it has a certain kind of importance in that way. And the title, Sha De Long, became a sort of buzzword in May 4th youth culture. It came to refer to like the family that you needed to break out of, the narrow cage that you needed to escape. That cage being maybe something like an iron house of traditional culture, or the restrictions of feudalism, what have you. The story itself, though, is very weird and a lot more contradictory and complex than the slogan. It's about a caged zoo tiger, a Bengal tiger, maybe reflecting on Yeroshenko's experience in India and Burma, who is disgusted by the smell of humanity and disgusted by being on view, being a spectacle. And he has this kind of beautiful nobility and a beautifully complex figural language. That is, he thinks to himself, I suppose, in tiger, but it's translated into, originally it was written in Japanese by Yeroshenko. Another amazing thing about Yeroshenko, that a lot of his writing was in Japanese and then translated into Chinese by Lu Xun. In any case, the tiger falls into a dream of his native haunts, of his native forest. It's actually not clear if it's a dream or not, but he finds himself back in his native haunts, and having had the experience of being locked up in a narrow cage, he resolves to free all the beings. And it's almost bodhisattva-like, all the beings who are still in bondage. But this has terrible unintended consequences. The sheep in a pen he wants to release don't want to be released, and he gets very angry at them. The goldfish in a tank don't want to swim out in the wide sea, and he ends up swiping the tank and knocking it over with predictable consequences. So this figure of liberation becomes also a sort of a figure of destruction for those he wants to liberate. So, of course, it's a parable about revolution. It's a parable about the unintended consequences of wanting to develop those you see as being undeveloped. And it turns out that once the tiger sort of falls in love with a Indian princess who is asked or is about to be burnt alive because of the death of her Maharaja. And some of this is sort of strange and probably politically incorrect appropriation of ideas about India at that time that circulated. He wants to save her from having to perform sati. And at the very moment that he's going to save her, basically the redcoats arrive, the British army arrives, the colonialists arrive. And so even this little bit of agency or this little bit of sort of initiative that he has is eventually taken away from him, and he's left utterly helpless. And it's difficult not to see this as a kind of parable about the post-colonial intellectual who wants to institute modern universal ideals and to become a liberator, but then finds himself trumped, as it were, by the fact that those modern universal ideas came from the West in the first place. So that's one way to read this parable, but there are many others. And that's one reason why I wanted to include the translation, because I think it's a very rich text, and my reading is just one reading, and I hope people will, get even more out of it.
Absolutely. And I think you're including the translation also lets us have this very rich text to use in teaching as well. I can see just there are tons of opportunities to use this in classes on China, on the history of colonialism, on all kinds of topics. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
So Andrew, this is obviously an extraordinarily rich book, and there are a million and one things that we could have talked about that we didn't have time to get to. But is there anything in particular about the book that we didn't cover, but that you'd like to specially point out for listeners who may not yet have had the opportunity to read it?
Well, I think we've actually covered a lot, and gone through chapter by chapter. I suppose one thing that I guess should be clear, but I could point out is that if the book has a hero or a zhurengong, a main figure, that's Lu Xun. And that was a kind of self-conscious choice I made to write a kind of stealth monograph about Lu Xun. I know author studies are a little bit, unfashionable, but in fact, there hasn't been there have been very few monographs solely devoted to his work in recent years. So it is also a book about Lu Xun, about his writing, and about his formation in the crucible, this kind of evolutionary thinking.
Great. And what are you working on now? What's next for you now that this book is now out in the world?
Well, I've already kind of launched into a new project, and I'm going back to my interest in music and in sonic culture and media technology. So right now I'm working on a study of primarily, I suppose you could say, of Chinese or music from the Chinese-speaking world in the 1960s. But I'm trying to situate it in terms of certain global changes in the technology of music production and dissemination at that time. And also looking at the kind of discourse of folk and folk music and the electrification of folk music, both in the People's Republic of China and also in Taiwan in the 60s and 70s. So that's the new book.
It sounds like another fascinating project. And as soon as that's done, let me know and we'll talk about that one as well.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Well, Andrew, We've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you so much for making the time
to talk
with us. The book is brilliant. It's a total pleasure to read, and I say that completely sincerely. And it's really given me a lot to think about, and I hope that it reaches a really wide audience. And I think it deserves a wide audience of not just scholars of modern China and Chinese literature, but also scholars of the history of science and medicine and evolutionary thinking and translation. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
This is Carla Nappi from New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much for being with us, and I'll see you next time.